I don't know. I'm a newcomer here. I'd like to know, what is it? Is it a lecture or a seminar? I would like to understand it better. If you could explain it to me. It's more of a symposium, a discussion, or a straight lecture. I mean, it depends upon you, I mean, gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, I mean, the same to me. It's a combination.
So, not really, I would...
Perhaps make a compromise. That I would lecture, but you have a right, and I would rather appreciate if you would interrupt my lecture, in case you had a question for me. This is my policy. I have been a teacher for many, many years. My policy is that if students interrupt me, if they want to ask me a question. So I would appreciate if you should interrupt me and something is not clear or you have a question and if you disagree with me.
Rabbi,
you
have to speak a little
loud. Yes. This is not a loudspeaker. I thought it was a loudspeaker. If you are... there's no loudspeaker here. So anyway,
would it be easier for you to sit in the middle of the room?
I believe it would be
nice. Excuse me a minute.
Philosophy of religion. Philosophy of religion at many levels. It means modern philosophy of religion, comparative philosophy of religion, medieval philosophers, Jewish and Christian, and so forth and so on. My training basically was not in the field of philosophy of religion, but the philosophy of science. Kantian, near Kantian philosophy. So perhaps I have a strange approach to philosophy of religion, because my training was not a theological one or exclusively in the field of philosophy of religion or religious thought. However, I've been, so to say, casting or thrusting, using an expression by Heidegger in a certain environment where philosophy of religion was considered important. I tried to interpret, Jewish religious concepts in philosophical terms. To tell you that I know much about it, I would not be sincere. Basically, I am very perplexed, and perhaps as perplexed as anybody else and more. And I don't believe that Judaism is a philosophy, is a religion which has many answers, like the Catholic philosophy. Judaism has many problems, but it's very few answers. Very few answers. And perhaps the more I lecture, the more perplexed you'll be, and the more I'll confuse you, sort of clearing up some problems in your mind. And however, but it's good if you can see a problem and to understand the problem is insoluble. And actually, my mind says that to be perplexed does not mean to be confused. And whatever I'll say, I'm not laying claim to any theoretical or cognitive validity. I don't know whether what I'm going to say is true or not. It's hard to say. We don't have criteria by which objectively to judge our opinions about Judaism. We have no laboratory, we have no tests. The empirical approach we have, I wouldn't say as developed as in the field of positive sciences. All I'll say to you is just my own subjective thoughts and feelings about Judaism. I have tried to interpret Judaism in modern terms. For the Jew in his encounter with the modern world, I've tried very hard. But it's only a subjective experience and a subjective interpretation on my part. I'm not out to convert anybody. I'm not carrying the gospel of Judaism. I lack missionary zeal. Take it as an act of confidence on my part, as confessing, or rather letting you share my own subjective experience, my own private experience. If you should find that my experience and there is some commensurability between your feelings and my experience, my efforts will be rewarded. However, if you should find that my experience and your experience are incommensurable, incongruous, then you'll disagree with me totally, I will not feel hurt.
But it's very hard to find some measurability between private experiences of many of individuals. So the trait of uniqueness actually precludes from measurability.
In general, whoever speaks about Judaism and makes an authoritative statement, I don't believe I'm not saying about Jewish law, but about Jewish philosophy, is wrong. It's just a subjective interpretation. We have no authority to determine which philosophy is such a perennial Jewish philosophy and which one is just a modern creation interpretation of Judaism. Now, I believe that the topic of our lectures would deal with man and his social institutions he created. But today I wouldn't speak about man. I'll just give an introduction as to the methodology of Judaism and how you can approach this problem. Judaism has a doctrine of man. Because if it has no doctrine of man, so it could get up and go home. As a matter of fact, such a doctrine underlies every civilized religion. Any civilized religion, not only Judaism, Christianity and Islam, must have a doctrine of man. Since religion is concerned with the relationship, with the triple relationship of God, man, and the world, this is the basic relationship in any philosophy of religion, it must necessarily possess some knowledge, on the one hand, of God's infinite will, which conveys to man the moral law, and the means by which this moral law is to be realized, and, on the other hand, of man himself, the subject of the good religious conduct and the ethical norm. And now, let me add something. Cognition, or knowledge, is one of the main motives which determine and shape the religious experience. The homo religiosus, it's a technical term, it means the man of religious experience. The homo religiosus is engaged in a cognitive gesture. He's basically a theoretical man, a homo theoreticus, or anthropos theoreticus. The intellectual urge is as potent in him as it is in the homo theoreticus. Curiosity prompts both the homo religiosus and the homo theoreticus to face the world and men in an inquisitive mood of inquiry. I am saying that because many theories in the history of philosophy and religion have maintained that religion is not a cognitive gesture. Either, as Schleiermacher wanted us to believe, an emotional gesture. And the main, so to say, the main experience of the homo religiosus can be reduced to the feeling of absolute dependence, or as Kant and the Neo-Kantian school maintained, the religious experience is an ethical one, a moral experience, the experience of the absolute intent. So Schleiermacher sentimentalized religion, Kant ethicized religion. Both of them have eliminated the intellectual urge of the homo religiosus. The homo religiosus doesn't want to know, but he wants to act. That's what Kant said. Schleiermacher said, the homo religiosus doesn't want to know, nor does he want to act. He feels something. He is emotionally unique. However, intellectually, volitionally, ethically, morally, there is no uniqueness to him, no singularity. However, it's impossible to maintain this attitude, particularly in modern religion. The religious experience has basic, central, intellectual, or cognitive motifs, like the homo theoreticus. Whoever he is, scientist, psychologist, philosopher, the religious person is a person who seeks knowledge. Of course, the objectives
and hence the method of the homo religiosus and the homo theoreticus are different. They vary. The homo theoreticus studies a reality bounded in by finitude. That's all. He doesn't know of any other reality. Finitude and reality are identical to him. Whose multifarious complexities are reduced or can be reduced to relational, formal, mathematical equations and to a system of the dynamic interdependencies whose rationale, the rationale of reality, and science must believe in the rationale of reality, but otherwise the scientists would never approach reality in a confident mood. There is a rationale in reality, whose rationale manifests itself in expressibility and technological applicability. This is the approach on the part of the scientist to reality. The homo religiosus explores being at a different level, not so much for the sake of discovering the here and now knowable, explainable, and useful aspect. He's also interested in that. But his main interest centers about something else. He's not so much interested in the, so to say, in the knowledge of reality, which is accessible to us, but is more interested in transcending the charted lanes of an orderly and neatly arranged cosmos or universe and venturing into the unknown, into remote empty distances and boundless stretches, into a strange and puzzling and baffling world which can neither be mathematized or interpreted, nor interpreted in abstract constructs and concepts, whose total equation, because for the homo theoreticus, the total equation of the universe is, it is knowable. Because if the universe were not knowable, comprehensible, there would be actually a gesture of resignation on the part of the scientist or the homo theoreticus. The equation, the total equation of the homo religiosus, says existence is a paradoxical affair, a mysterium magnum, which inspires a man awe and tremor. Of course, ladies and gentlemen, in order to arrive at such an absurd equation, or if I may use Kierkegaard's expression, to perform the movement of resignation, which is basic for the homo religiosus, homo religiosus must resign from time to time. In order to perform the act or the movement of complete resignation, the homo religiosus must explore every nook and corner of reality. Examine, search every aspect of being and try to interpret even the minutest process in reality. Because the act of resignation on the part of the homo religiosus is not to be equated with the naivete of the uninitiated, ignorant person who denies the worth of knowledge because he doesn't know anything. Not to be equated. Wherever the homo religiosus is, he must not be an ignorant person, nor must he be an arrogant person. Ignorance and arrogance are certain traits which are strange to the religious experience, incommensurate with the religious awareness. I mean, this skepticism which flows from an arrogant attitude is alien to the homo religiosus. The act of resignation on the part of the homo religiosus is rather to be compared with the skepsis of the ecclesiast or the despair of Faust by Goethe, who because of having attained great intellectual height, because of their incessant drinking from the fountainhead of wisdom, and their mastery of the cognitive gesture, and their insatiable curiosity, have arrived at the conclusion that being is an insoluble equation. But it is a resignation which follows knowledge and completes the act of knowing, not an act of resignation which precludes knowledge, because to resign before one knows is not resignation. This is arrogance and ignorance. Of course, only the mathematician can prove that certain equations are insoluble. The person who is not initiated in mathematics cannot prove that. And the homo religiosus is the mathematician who tries to prove, who feels that the total equation of reality is an insoluble one, perhaps a great mystery. But he is a man of knowledge. He is an intellectual. He is driven by the so-called, if I may use a Kantian expression, the metaphysical impulse. He wants to know. Not only wants to act, not only he feels differently, he wants to know. And of course, the homo religiosus knows of and is concerned with and is guided by an by existential purposes which surpass the boundary lines of finitude. True. He's also in another respect, it is different from the scientist. The scientist studies only the reality which is bounded in by finitude, by the frames of reference of time and space. However, the homo religiosus knows of another existence. I wouldn't say another existence, because this would sound a little too theological, but of an existence which transcends the boundaries of finitude. And the boundaries of finitude which is conditioned by temporality. Yet, irrespective of the ultimate end which religion pursues, and which is above and outside the worldly ambitions and aspirations of the homo theoreticus, irrespective of that, the drama of religion unfolds only within the confines of our natural orders. It means within the confines of this worldliness. Right here and now, and this is basically Jewish, right here and now, in a world of sound and color, of sensuous complexities, of change and development, of mechanical motion and unalterable processes, the homo man has his rendezvous with infinity, with God. In order to meet God, one does not have to transcend this world. Although perhaps he knows of a higher existence, but meeting God, and this is basically Jewish. Perhaps Christianity disagrees. I would say medieval Christianity. And this respect will come later. This point will return to this point. The Jewish opinion was, Jews always said, Judaism, that one meets God right here and now, within the confines of time and space. Here and now, in the midst of the events, of a world of events and things, of mechanical orders, man rises to great heights and meets his creator, and he also falls into a bottomless abyss of sin and actually inferior existence. Right here and now, he rebels against God and his authority, which he accepted prior to his rebellion, and right here now, he returns to God meekly and humbly, like a child who apologizes to his father, against whom he rebelled a while ago. But it's in the right here and now reality. Right here and now, man struggles with absurdity and insensateness and tries to infuse meaning into something unknown which we call existence. If, of course, gentlemen, the theater of religious activities, of religious self-expression and self-realization is to be found here in our sensuous world, then understanding of an acquaintanceship with the latter, with this world, is a conditio sine qua non for the proper guiding, for the proper realization of our religious destiny. So it means what I wanted to say is that religion lays claims to knowledge, and this knowledge does not pertain to eternity or to some transcendental entities or to some spiritual beings, but religion wants to know this world, this corporeal, sensuous world, in all its manifestations and in all its, so to say, at all its levels, like the scientists or the homo theoretics. And of course, ladies and gentlemen, it is a truism that although the cognitive gesture of the homo religiosus is a comprehensive one, aiming at reality in its entirety, manifesting itself in a variety of orders, the homo religiosus is mainly concerned with the order of personal existence. Or to be more exact, with himself. Of course he wants to know the world, sadly. No doubt about it. But he's more concerned with himself. Perhaps there is a distinction between the homo theoreticus and the homo religiosus. The homo theoreticus, until recently actually, was more concerned with the outside world, with the physical processes, with motion, since the days of Thales. He was more concerned with the organic matter, with the process of life, which is also, I mean, belongs into the outside world. He was less concerned with himself, the scientist, because simply if the scientist had been concerned with himself as much as he was concerned with the outside world, with dead matter and animate matter, then perhaps psychology and sociology, all the humanities, would have progressed much more. Because actually knowledge of man is a latecomer in the history of science. It's a newcomer, actually. All right, in history of philosophy, you know, Socrates said, what is man? But it was a different approach. It was not knowledge, theoretical knowledge. It was more a practical problem. What should man do in order to be happy? This was the general problem of the Greek philosophers. Not who is man, what is man, what is the existential experience, what kind of a being he is, what is his uniqueness, singularity, his station in the world, in the universe, I mean, his struggle with the outside world and struggle with himself. No, this was not the problem of Socrates, nor was it the problem of Aristotle or Plato, his master Plato, nor was it the problem of the Stoics and the Epicurean school. The problem was a practical one, a pragmatic one, a functional problem. How can man be happy? How can he attain eudaimony, or what they call it, pleasure, hedone? It's a practical problem. And the whole discussion about man in Greek philosophy, in the late antique, I mean, the Greek philosophy, from Socrates and down, so it did not revolve about the metaphysic of man or theory of man, it was more revolving about the practical discipline of man. How can man be happy? It's a technological problem about man, not a theoretical problem. And you know very well that technological problems cannot be solved unless you do basic research. And this was the trouble with the Greek philosophy. When it came, I mean, to the outside world, They were pure theoreticians. The pragmatic view absolutely did not mislead them at all. They wanted to understand for the sake of knowledge. Of course, you know, the idea of technology was alien to the Greek. Completely alien. Because the type of knowledge he was pursuing did not lend itself to technological application. However, when he came to man himself, he suddenly turned into a technician. Not who is man, what is man, but how should man act in order to be. And of course, the homo religiosus is concerned with man and has a double problem. Who is man? And also the old Greek problem, the pragmatic problem. What shall a man do in order, to realize or to find self-fulfillment? Religion must possess intimate knowledge and understanding at all levels of the existential experience, or what you call self-awareness. Otherwise, the God-man relationship could remain an enigma to the homo religiosus. If he doesn't understand himself, how can he approach God? However universally true the aforementioned maxim is, that the homo religiosus is intellectual type and is particularly interested in self-knowledge, it is true. Various religions differ as to the manner in which they emphasize the above-mentioned cognitive aspects of the homo religiosus. While most religious systems, and I'm speaking, I know that when I say most religious systems, I am referring to Occidental religion. I have very little knowledge of Oriental religion. I have no right to speak, not even to mention it. Occidental religion, I understand Christianity and Islam. I'm quite well acquainted with Christian scholastics. Most religious systems were more prone to the theological thinking and developed theosophic doctrines, focusing their attention upon transcendental reality. And they developed only latent religious anthropologies. I mean, to distinguish it from scientific anthropology, you call religious anthropology. When you say religious anthropology, it means the metaphysic of man, the interpretation of man, formulated in religious terms. Of course, for instance, take Christianity. They have a social philosophy, no doubt about it. I mean, Thomas Aquinas developed quite an extensive social philosophy based upon natural law, lex naturalis or lex naturae. But however, it's funny, it's strange, they developed a social philosophy without inquiring into the essence of man. How can you develop a social philosophy before you inquire into man for himself? Regardless of all the controversies about the relationship of man for himself, man within the community, we'll come later to this problem, this controversy. You know, the community precedes the individual, and the individual precedes the community, I mean systematically, conceptually. But however, Thomas Aquinas was not concerned with the problem, who is man? He was concerned, what is society? And that is the reason why social philosophy is incomplete, because it lacks the basic, so to say, the basic premise knowledge of man for himself, man in seclusion. Man communing not with the other self, but man communing with himself. That only lately the Christian philosophy began to develop. And actually this aspect of religious anthropology, dealing with the individual. And of course, this is what's known to us under the name or the title religious existentialism. Well, there are many books were written about religious existentialism. What it is, it means the philosophy of man interpreted in terms of Christianity. That is exactly, more or less, if we want to simplify this equation. However, Judaism occupied a very unique, so to say, position in the world of religion. While other religions stressed the idea of God more than that of man, Judaism, in its intellectual pursuits, concentrated on man. And religious anthropology replaced in Judaism theology. We have always inquired into the essence of man, never into the essence of God. Our world formula is quite paradoxical. It is theocentric, God-centric, theocentric. However, anthropo-oriented. We are orientated on man. We concentrate, so to say, more teleologically on God. Of course, God is the beginning and the ultimate end of everything. Judaism maintains that as any other civilized religion. Because if it's not the beginning and the end of everything, there's no need for religion. I can never understand the religion becomes so modernized that the idea of God is eliminated. Not that the zeal of the fanatic, is that what makes me rebel against it, but a simple question. If this is religion, so there is no need to spend so much money on its institutions. We are theocentric, but anthropo-orientated. Of course, God is the beginning and the ultimate end of everything. In him, the fullness of existence is realized, and all yearnings of man find fulfillment. No doubt about it. It's very important for the therapeutic aspects of religion. Yet God himself, creator of the world, out of whose pure, absolute, infinite being, finitude emerged, God himself remains to us, the Jews, Keil Mistater Beshafre Chelien, Deus Absconditus, a mysterium tremendum, a hidden God, inapproachable, unknowable, inexpressible, eluding the grasp of our concept. And if you'll allow me, I want here to just to raise one dichotomy, to call your attention to one dichotomy, or rather to an antithesis in our religious experience. Our experience of God, the Judaic experience of God, of course, you find it in other religions as well. But particularly the Judaic experience of God is antithetic. Insofar, it contains an awareness of both, of endless remoteness and mystery on the one hand, and of intimate closeness and familiarity on the other hand. Don't ask me how is it possible, because basically Judaism in its approach to God did not operate with the Aristotelian two-valued logic, or with the famous principle of contradiction or the excluded middle. Aristotle said, if it is A, it cannot be at the same time B. If it is B, it cannot be at the same time A. It's either A or B. And if it's A or B, it cannot be something else. We Jews say, it's typical of our mentality. It can be A in the same time B. And not only it can be A at the same time B, it can be A and the same time B and also something else than A and B. I mean, you know, ladies and gentlemen, modern physics, classical physics, operates with this. For instance, you know, the theory of light is interpreted nowadays both in terms of waves and in terms of particles, although both theories are mutually exclusive. So apparently, actually, the modern advanced mathematics and advanced physics actually cannot operate simply. The mess of phenomena does not lend itself to a two-valued logical interpretation. The principle of contradiction and the principle of the excluded middle was thrown away by the science. But in the religious approach, it's certainly that we operate with antithetic ideas, concepts. On the one hand, he is remote, on the other hand, he is close. In our encounter with God, we find ourselves many a time bewildered by the opposition of two experiential alternatives. First, as I said before, Deus absconditus, God who is hiding in the depths of infinity and eternity. And second, as the psalmist says, Karov Hashem l'chol korav, the Lord is nigh unto all that call upon him, to all that call upon him in truth and sincerity. He is both, he is nigh and remote. He is near and far away. This is the Jewish experience of God. On the one hand, we experience God as dwelling apart and beyond all dimensions of being, hidden in the remotest recesses of infinity, is unapproachable and incomprehensible, abiding in concealment and in the shadows of transcendence. And the word, the Hebrew word kadosh, holy, whoever knows the etymological meaning of kadosh, know that kadosh actually in Hebrew signifies separateness, difference, otherness, incommensurability, something which doesn't belong into this order, something mysterious. It signifies the withdrawal of God from me. On the other hand, the homo religiosus feels also the immediate presence of God. He is endless remoteness and also the immediate presence of God. Outside and within him, God is man's haven, if you will, his fortress, his habitation, where men reside. He experiences God as his companion, father, mother, friend. The word I'm quoting are taken from the Bible. The Bible is the book of the Judaic religious experience. Mother, friend, lover and beloved both together, who caresses his head, bend under the load of existence, and whispers words of condolence and hope to him. He is the shepherd who cares for the helpless and the weak, and carries the young in his possession. It's a quotation from Isaiah. On the one hand, Deus absconditus, on the other hand, Deus revelatus, close to us. On the one hand, mysterium tremendum, magnum, distant, strange, and unknowable, inspiring dread and awe. And on the other hand, Deus revelatus, involved in creation in every aspect of existence, addressing himself to us through every twinkle of the distant star, through every budding tree, out of the stillness of a summer night, the cry of the infant, and the innocent laughter of the child, through one's thoughts, feelings, strivings, and yearnings, and on the other hand, distant, incomprehensible, strange. Far in infinity, in the recesses of infinity. He confronts us both as an adversary, as an antagonist, and as a friend. As a stranger and as a father. As a familiar figure, if I may use this expression, and as a mysterious person. You know, Jacob, who was wrestling with the stranger, who was the stranger, if not the same God who spoke to him a night before. The experience is antithetic. It's dichotomous. It's mutually exclusive. But still, this antithesis and this dichotomy actually lend to the religious experience its uniqueness, greatness, and magnificence. But of course, we must realize, keep in mind, that while the individual homo religiosus may engage in a paradoxical experience, fraught with incommensurate aspects, an incongruous theme, oscillating between complete resignation and passionate, ecstatic joy, the community, the institutionalized religion, must organize its collective experience along coherent patterns, and cannot afford to tolerate polarity within our religious awareness. What is good for the at an esoteric level is absolutely inoperative at a exoteric level. What is good for the few individuals, for the hominis religiosi, for the great religious genius, is absolutely incomprehensible for the average person. So of course, therefore, if you will, for instance, study the history of religion, you'll find that some religions have emphasized the aspect of remoteness of God. In other religions, on the contrary, introduce God as familiar figure. Although the religious experience, the private religious experience of the homo religiosus, has both motives, the motive of remoteness and the motive of closeness as well. For instance, you take Christianity. Why was the concept of father-son introduced? Why was this Trinitarian motif introduced in Christianity? Philosophically? Simply, I mean, whoever reads the literature of the fathers of the desert, of the fathers of the desert, or read the literature of Saint Augustine, his Confessions, the City of God, and so forth on, I mean, that Christianity actually was torn by two motives. By the motive of closeness of God and remoteness of God. By the motive of Deus absconditus, the hidden God. And by the motive of Deus revelatus, the revealed God, the God who is close to me, who is within me, who has intercourse with me, who is my companion, to whom I can address myself, I can pray, I can complain, I may rebel, I may engage in a dialogue. And the final result was that God Father is the remote one, and the Son is the one who was walking on earth, associating with people, speaking to them. That's why in Christianity, in Christian theology, you know very well, all prayers cannot be addressed to the Father unless we beseech the Son to mediate between us and the Father. Why? Because the Father is too remote for prayer. Prayer cannot reach him. There is no way for man to find access to God Father. That's why the actions simply split divinity into two entities and introduce the Son. It means the God who is close to them. Judaism, a Unitarian religion, couldn't do that. So in Judaism, it is an antithesis, a dichotomy of closeness and remoteness. Yeah, the question is, what did Judaism do with the problem of its institutionalized religion? Judaism is also, it's a private experience, it's also an institutionalized religion. Any religion must be institutionalized,
something, because the word religion itself, I mean, indicates institutionalization. Institutionalized, conceptualized, made, so to say, available to the crowd. So you cannot, you see, for instance, education. There were times when education was considered the privilege of the select few of the aristocratic society. In England, had such a system. Actually, old Greece, I mean, actually believed in aristocracy as far as education is concerned. You can say, Eliot says that art is only a product of the place of leisure. Okay. But no one can say that religion should be, so to say, limited to the select few, for a simple reason. Because from our viewpoint, religion saves man, giving salvation and redemption. And we think that everybody is entitled to salvation and redemption, not only the philosopher, but the simpleton as well, not only the aristocrat, but the slave as well. So you cannot turn the religious experience into an esoteric affair for the philosopher, for the inquiring mind, for the person who simply encounters God. Means and ways must be found in order to simplify the religious experience and to make it available and accessible to every person. And the dichotomous religious experience is an esoteric affair. Exoterically, the average person on the street cannot understand the dichotomy. It's either or. The principle of contradiction that Aristotle introduced into logic is simply common sense. It's either black or white. It cannot be between, or gray, I mean, all right. What either black or either it's a square or it's round. What, or a circle. It cannot be both. So what did Judaism do? What motive was emphasized not in the private experience of that, the Judaic private experience? The Judaic private experience, as it was depicted and described in the Psalms, this is the greatest book on religious experience in general, I believe, and I am never apologetic about it, but it's the greatest book of the religious experience in general. Everybody agrees with it. As far as it's concerned, the psalmist was a religious genius, I mean, the real homo religiosus. In him you find Psalms, the famous Psalm, God is my shepherd, I shall not want. So how is God depicted, described there? Close, companion, my shepherd. I associate with him. I engage in a dialogue with him. I bend my tired head on his shoulder. And he whispers into me in words of hope to me. And the same psalmist, the next day, in the next chapter begins to say, where can I escape from you? Where can I find you? I have searched you everywhere. I found you nowhere. I came to your sanctuary, to your temple. I thought I'll find you there, but you are not there. I searched in the woods. I didn't find your shadow. Why? On the one hand, he speaks of God as his companion, his shepherd. On the other hand, in the same breath, he says he can't find God, he doesn't know where he is. It's what we say, numen presence, numen absence. God is present and absent.